This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Kanary. Thanks for joining us. Later this hour, we're going to get the local outlook from a new report from the Union of Concerned Scientists called Killer Heat that projects the additional number of extremely hot days we might be facing if steps aren't taken to slow down climate change. And then we'll meet the research entomologist who's been working for 15 years on a plan to combat invasive Brazilian pepper trees here in Florida using tiny insects called thrips. That project gets underway today. But first, about 13 years ago, a borough in Pennsylvania passed an ordinance prohibiting corporations from dumping waste sludge into open pit mines by mandating that any resident could sue on behalf of the rights of natural communities and ecosystems. Since then, more than three dozen communities across the U.S. have adopted similar rights of nature measures. 2 years ago, Ecuador wrote the rights of nature into its new constitution. While the idea of giving rights to the natural environment might sound strange, advocates point to other times in history when rights were extended to people or entities that are also probably outrageous at the time to at least some people. Think freeing slaves, or giving women the right to vote, or recognizing corporations as people. On today's show, we're going to learn about this rights of nature movement and a local effort to get on board by creating the Caloosahatchee River Bill of Rights. I'm joined on the phone by Thomas Allen Lindsay. He's executive director and co-founder of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund and its chief legal counsel. The CELDF is the driving force behind this rights of nature movement globally. Thomas, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Mike.
And here in studio, I'm joined by Captain Carl Deigert. He is treasurer of the environmental advocacy nonprofit Clean Water Now, which is spearheading this local effort to give the river rights. Carl, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate the opportunity to bring awareness.
And as always, we do invite you to join our conversation. What are your thoughts on this idea of extending rights to the natural world? The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Thomas, for starters, tell us a bit about the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund and its history.
Sure, Mike. So we're a public interest law firm. Got our start back in 1995. And for about 10 years, we did what I refer to as conventional or traditional environmental law. So representing communities that didn't want things like toxic waste incinerators or factory hog farms, or the frack wells, or the types of projects that people around the country living in communities don't necessarily want siting in their neighborhoods. And for those 10 years, we relied on conventional environmental laws like the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act, or doing zoning permit appeals, basically anything that was in the existing toolbox that we had to grab onto. And during those 10 years, we grew disillusioned with the status of conventional environmental laws, mostly for two reasons. Number one was that no matter the industry that we were fighting, whether it was the waste management industry or the agribusiness industry, that the corporations themselves who controlled those industries, and like today in the agribusiness industry, 60% of the hog production facilities are owned by three corporations in the United States, that those corporations tended to be the ones writing the regulations themselves that ostensibly were supposed to regulate those operations. And logically, you can conclude from that process that the corporations were writing regulations that were very favorable to them. And the second thing that we learned during that period of time was that the environmental laws really protect solely human types of interests in waterways or in ecosystems. So clean drinking water, for example, is an interest protected by the environmental laws. But unfortunately, because the environmental laws are so homocentric or human-centered in many ways, that they overlook the other values that are biocentric, that these ecosystems have. And eventually we came to the conclusion that the only way that the interests of the natural world were going to be protected, and by virtue of protection of the natural world, protection of human interests as well, was through an elevation of protection of those ecosystems. And that led us to begin work on this concept of rights for ecosystems, essentially raising ecosystems in the natural environment to the highest protections possible under U.S. law. And the proof is really in the pudding of where we sit today in terms of things are worse now by almost every major environmental statistic than they were 40 years ago when we passed these conventional environmental laws and regulatory schemes. and that something has to change. And so for the past 15, 20 years, we've been assisting not only municipalities to think about this new system of law, like the city of Pittsburgh, which passed a rights of nature law several years ago, is the largest municipality in the country to do so, but also to assist folks in other countries like Nepal and Ecuador and India and Colombia and Brazil and Mexico, who are seeing this emerging system of new rights-based environmental protection as slowly beginning to replace that old system that was based on regulatory systems and these conventional environmental laws. So that's how we arrived at this point.
Let's talk real quick about Pittsburgh. How can you describe sort of the arc that happened there from this idea first entering the consciousnesses of local people in Pittsburgh and then it being passed? You know, how long did that take and how hard a climb was that?
So it was pretty fast in the city of Pittsburgh, mostly because there was a fracking company that had secured rights to frack for natural gas underneath a Catholic cemetery within the city. And as you can imagine, that kind of proposal to frack within urban limits, but also to do it underneath a cemetery within the city, aroused some pretty strong opposition to that project. And not only did the city council folks vote unanimously to adopt an ordinance banning fracking within city limits, they also saw the value of creating a rights-based system for the three rivers that pass through the city of Pittsburgh, recognizing that those rivers had a right to exist and flourish and be healthy. Because one of the problems with fracking, of course, is that it produces these huge amounts of toxic wastewater, and the gallons of wastewater were being dumped and continue to affect those three river system in the city of Pittsburgh. So, in other words, the council decided to take two actions, one which was short-term, which was to say, hey, we're going to ban fracking within city limits, and the second one was a future approach saying we want to protect these ecosystems that exist within the urban boundaries with the highest level of environmental protections that the U.S. system allows.
Have there been any challenges in court to those protections since they were enacted?
There have not in the city of Pittsburgh. It's the fracking ban has held to date with an understanding that's been in place now for over 7 years. And as you mentioned in your intro, there are over three dozen municipalities in the United States that have these rights of nature laws on the books. But make no doubt about it, as you also referenced, that this is a movement of sorts which is about giving rights to something that has previously been recognized as rightless. And following in the footsteps of the abolitionists and the suffragists, it means a sea change in how we actually treat nature under our system of law. Currently, nature under most constructs in Western civilization is treated as property. If you own a 10-acre piece of property, it carries with it the legal guarantee or the legal right to destroy the ecosystems on that piece of property. And we've tried to build an environmental protection system based on that property-based protection model, which hasn't worked. We're now facing some of the largest crises in environmental protection, the natural environment, that we've seen in the last 50 years. So something clearly isn't working, and people don't necessarily say, okay, we're going to build a different paradigm here from scratch just for the sake of doing it. The people are building a different paradigm from scratch because it's absolutely necessary not only for our own survival but also to provide adequate protection to the natural environment.
Can you give any examples of other instances in history where non-human entities have been given rights in a similar manner?
Sure. It has happened more than we would think over the course of history. The example you gave earlier was corporations acquiring certain rights. A corporation is a piece of paper, of course. We can create a corporation tomorrow on a piece of paper and it becomes property. It can be bought or sold. Yet under the system of law, that piece of property has been given certain constitutional rights, which now constrain our authority to actually govern ourselves. So the best example is the Citizens United decision, which a lot of people have heard about, which was a corporation using its First Amendment free speech rights to knock down campaign finance restrictions that had been passed by Congress. So a lot of times we think these corporate rights just exist out there, but unfortunately they don't just exist, they are enforced routinely to knock down laws that our federal, state, and local governments deem are necessary to protect health, safety, and welfare. So corporations as property is one example of that. Sometimes the line that we use when we talk about corporate rights is it's as silly as your refrigerator having rights. you know, that your refrigerator in your kitchen has some kind of enforceable rights. That's as silly a concept as corporations having rights, but under a system of law, that's been the law for the past close to 200 years. And there are other examples through the law. Ships can sue each other under maritime law. Guardianship and trustee for children who are incapable of making litigation decisions in judicial fora. So in courts, we assign trustees and guardian ad litems to those individuals to appear in court to defend the best interests of the child. So there are multiple examples about rights being used in different ways to safeguard the interests of those entities. And we would also make a distinction between ships and corporations, which are inanimate property objects, having rights versus ecosystems upon which all life on Earth depends. And it always sounds kind of woo-woo to say that, but you know, the air that we breathe, the water that we drink, the natural environment itself supports our survival needs. And so this isn't just about let's protect the river for the river's sake. It's also about protecting our own survival by providing the highest level of protections to these ecosystems.
How many communities in the U.S. have passed these kinds of resolutions or laws, or how do you describe it? Is it a, it's not a law, is it? How exactly are they enacted?
So they are binding, enforceable laws that are adopted usually one of two ways within municipalities. So we're talking about cities, villages, counties. We're talking about municipal units within the United States that have adopted rights of nature laws as binding, enforceable laws through an ordinance. And like I said, it takes place usually one of two ways. One is that we are retained as a law firm because we're a public interest law firm by the municipal officials who wish to write a rights of nature law and then adopt it into place within the municipality. In those places where there are communities that are not necessarily running parallel with their elected officials, there are usually options for those communities to put the issue directly onto the ballot, and that means them writing the law themselves and then qualifying it for the ballot through a collection of signatures, placing it on the ballot directly, then running a campaign and having a public vote to actually adopt the measure. The most recent example of that second option was the Lake Erie Bill of Rights, which was adopted back in February 26th by the residents of the city of Toledo to provide legally enforceable rights to Lake Erie, which has been under threat from these blooms in the lake, which have recently, in recent memory, cut off 500,000 people's drinking water because it made Lake Erie toxic from the deposits from the distribution of excess waste from the agribusiness operations that operate upstream from Lake Erie. So those are the two ways it usually gets done, and there's been a lot of interest from people in Florida, especially with the red tide and the blue-green algae problems and the other issues that are affecting the natural environment there, to move forward with enacting some new kind of heightened environmental protections for those ecosystems.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with Thomas Allen Lindsay. He's executive director and co-founder of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund and its chief legal counsel. I'm also joined in studio by Captain Carl Dygert. He's treasurer of Clean Water Now. We're learning about what's called the Rights of Nature Movement and a local effort to add the Caloosahatchee River Bill of Rights to the Lee County Home Rule Charter. If you'd like to ask either of them a question or weigh in on our conversation, give us a call now. The number's 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we are at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Carl Dygert, how did you get involved with this?
So, I was brought to the Rights of Nature by my friend Sherry Straub. She's the president of Clean Water Now. She was a resident of Toledo in Ohio. She was there when they lost their drinking water for several days. She had been consuming that water unknowingly. She thinks she's been affected, that her health has been affected by that. So when she introduced me to it, I dug into it a little bit, and it was like an epiphany. I said, this is can bring change, and I'm all in on this effort to do this here in Florida.
Have you had any conversations with anybody in the county government or anybody, you know, affiliated with the county about this notion?
Right. So Ms. Straub did have a meeting with Councilman Pendergrass. I have a future meeting in August with Frank Mann, and the folks out on Sanibel are getting involved as well.
What kind of response did they get from Commissioner Pendergrass, or did she get, I suppose?
When she left the meeting, the feeling was a positive feedback.
Okay. So did I get that right? The idea would be to amend the county's home rule charter, which is, I guess it's like founding document or something like that.
That's correct. So in Florida, there's 20 charter organized counties of the 67 counties. But the interesting thing is that these 20 counties hold 74% of the population. Mm. So we now have Alachua County, we have Orange County, now Lee County. And if we can do this in every county, we have 74% of the population aware of what we're doing, and then maybe we can make some changes at the state level.
So Alachua County has passed something like this. They're considering passing something like this. Where are they in their process?
Their process is that they're going to take their amendment language to charter review every year. I don't know the exact number. Maybe Thomas does. Every few years, these charters must be by law revisited for amendment.
Gotcha. Thomas, do you have anything you can add to that about Alachua County?
Charter review commissions are pretty common, and a lot of Florida counties that have charters are going through this automatic charter review commission phase. The most recent news, I think, is that the Orange County Charter Review Commission voted to forward the proposal into the hopper of different proposals that they're considering for the addition to the vote that will be taken on the proposed new home rule amendments in that county. So that's a favorable development. But folks across Florida, not just in one place, but a bunch of different counties, are considering how to move this type of legislation. And again, it's not really out of choice. A lot of them are hardcore activists who have worked to protect rivers and other ecosystems for a number of years and are turning to this option only because they feel that it's one of the last ones available to protect the environment.
Carl, you know, with last year's or year and a half long red tide offshore bloom, and with the cyanobacteria in the river and in the lake and in the canals, and with the growing understanding that cyanobacteria is toxic to humans, do you think that this might actually resonate in a way that it might not have, you know, 5 or 10 years ago?
Absolutely, because, you know, over the last 2 years, we've attended the council meetings at the municipality level, the county level. We go to the meetings with the South Florida Water Management District, the Army Corps of Engineers, and we hear the same stale rhetoric over and over again. The cans kicked down the road with no change. Here we can bring effective change. It's going to be slow. It's an actual movement, but it can happen, and we're going to make it happen here in Lee County.
Thomas, can you characterize what kinds of communities have done this so far across the country? And by that I mean, it's not necessarily, from what I understand, just what you would consider to be, you know, environmentally progressive communities, because some of it's about rural communities too that have maybe more of a conservative bent.
Yeah, it's been a real diverse bunch. So you mentioned back in 2006 the community of Tamaqua, a borough in Pennsylvania, so like a city, small city in Pennsylvania, was the first to adopt a rights of nature ordinance within the United States. And they're a conservative Republican community is Tamaqua, and the plan there was to bring in dredge material that was full of PCB from the Delaware River. And folks there made a stand against it and actually stopped it from coming into the community, and at the same time passed this rights of nature ordinance into law. So I think it's more about local control in some ways and common home rule concepts about, hey, the state has failed to do their job, and the federal government has failed to do their job, and we don't trust that process anymore, that we're done with that, because it tends to be that those agencies are run not by the officials that are chosen to run them, but the largest economic actors in the regions in which those agencies operate. And that's not conducive to actually protecting these ecosystems. And so I think that local control component really crosses party lines and between liberal and conservative, that some of the biggest advocates for rights of nature laws have been sportsmen. So trout fishermen in rural Pennsylvania have been advocates for it because the existing law doesn't really allow them to protect the rivers in which they're fishing. And so some of this is just logical, rational evolution of people assigning the highest legal interests within the legal system to protecting ecosystems. And I think watching from afar, what's happening in Florida, I think Florida is almost the perfect storm between the Lake Okeechobee steps that have been taken by the Corps of Engineers and the resulting impact on other communities. I think if there's a place where rights of nature should find purchase, it is in those places that are facing the most starkest environmental conditions.
I read that Ohio's latest state budget had language in it prohibiting this idea in response to that Lake Erie Bill of Rights. Is that, A, is that correct, and B, is that precedented elsewhere?
Yeah, it is correct. It's the first time a state legislature has taken a stance against the rights of nature concept in the United States. We always find it fascinating as these campaigns roll out. This was 61% of the population, voting population of Toledo, that voted in favor of recognizing Lake Erie as having certain legally enforceable rights, including the right to exist and flourish. So almost like a right to life and then a right to be healthy. Those are the two core rights that were contained within the Lake Erie Bill of Rights. And what happened next was shouldn't be surprising to anyone, but it still came as a shock to some, which was 24 hours after the law was voted in by the electorate, corporate farmers, agribusiness interests sued to overturn it. So 24 hours later, in fact, it wasn't even 24 hours, less than that. And then the legislative assembly, the House of Representatives in particular, then attached a ban on rights of nature provisions being adopted and enforced within the state of Ohio by any municipality into a budget bill. And so I think it begins to show people exactly who makes decisions and who controls what, because it's a backhanded compliment in some ways. It says that this concept is powerful enough to actually make some long-lasting, substantive, deep change, and because of that, it affects existing economic interests that are opposed to those changes being made. And to an extent that those economic interests are now going to lengths to use state governments and other entities like courts to try to stop these things from being implemented. So far from being shocked by it, I think we need to expect it, that this is the environment literally in which we're working, and we need to not be shocked by these developments as they transpire, especially in Florida, where I think there are certain vested interests that will be opposed to this concept moving forward because it threatens their basic use of these ecosystems for their own profit.
All right. That is all the time we have for this part of the show. I want to thank my guests. Thomas Allen Lindsay is Executive Director and Co-Founder of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund and its Chief Legal Counsel. Mr. Lindsay, thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Mike.
And Captain Carl Dygert is Treasurer of Clean Water Now. Carl, thanks for coming in for the show.
Thank you very much.
And we've been talking about what's called the Rights of Nature Movement. Thomas Lindsay will be leading a public workshop this Saturday, July 20th, from 8:30 to 4:30 at KJ's Fresh Grill in Fort Myers. There will be another workshop on Sunday that's by invitation only. You can find a link to those details on our website, gulfcoastlive.org. When we return, a new peer-reviewed report from the Union of Concerned Scientists finds potentially lethal heat driven by climate change will affect every state in the U.S. in the decades ahead, especially southern states like Florida. We're joined by one of the report's authors to drill down to the Southwest Florida predictions. I'm Mike Canary. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.